Hello there, I'm Chuck Todd. I just stepped off the Meet the Press set. I interviewed National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan and Alaska Senator Dan Sullivan. No relation, or at least no close relation as far as either one of them are. No. We look back on a full year of war in Ukraine and outline how likely it is that public support to aid the Ukrainian effort will wane before we get to year three. We also set up this split screen between Biden and Warsaw, former President Trump traveling to East Palestine, Ohio, Trump trying to chide President Biden for not having come down to Ohio himself and also invoking the cost of the war, something to keep an eye on throughout the year, especially in Republican primary politics. But I want to take a step back and reflect on the legacy of President Jimmy Carter, who just spent a week in hospice care. I'm sitting here now with someone who knows him better than most people alive, and that's journalist and author Jonathan Alter. He wrote a terrific 2020 biography, His Very Best, Jimmy Carter, A Life. Mr. Alter, it's good to see you.
Good to see you, Chuck.
You know, I don't know when the right time it is to assess a presidency, but I feel like 40 years isn't bad. And you were a 40-year reflection, sort of, you sort of iron out all the partisanship a little bit. You get to almost look at it and see sort of long-term things. So bust a few myths. What's a myth about Carter that you feel like you were able to bust in your look at him?
Well, I'll leave it to others to determine whether I successfully busted the myth. But the main one that I wanted to bust was lousy president, great former president who got more done after he left office.
Right. That's the elevator take.
Right.
Right.
And the elevator take. Anybody you talk to
would say that same thing. If they were alive during Carter, oh yeah, nice man, terrible president.
Right. So the problem with that is that former presidents, even if they're very inspiring as Carter is, even if they accomplish certain things, like Carter has nearly eradicated Guinea worm disease that afflicted 3.5 million people, and now there's like 25 cases in the whole world. So there are real accomplishments after he left office. But former presidents don't have any power.
Right.
And so he accomplished—
They have a platform.
They have a platform, yeah. But in terms of actually changing the country and the world, what he did as president is what made the difference. Now, as journalists, we judge politicians and presidents by how they do politically.
Did the voters rehire them?
Right. Right. Historians should judge politicians and presidents by how their policies change the country and the world. And by that standard, while Jimmy Carter obviously doesn't belong on Mount Rushmore, and he admitted to the country in the so-called malaise speech where he didn't use the word malaise, but that he had a mixed record of success. That's all true. But if you actually look at the dozens of bills that he signed, they led to many far-sighted changes. So I concluded that Jimmy Carter was a political failure, but a substantive and often visionary success as president.
So let's talk about, it seems like that he had a couple of Achilles heels that maybe prevented him from having a successful president politically. And look, one of my favorite, Carter wrote so many books that if you read all of his books, you'd need the year. To fit it. Yeah, he was very prolific.
There's a reason I worked for 5 years.
I was just going to say, well, you have so much resource material from him and access
Carter
to him.
Carter Library.
Right. I found his diaries to be just, I wish every president was as thorough with their daily diaries and then did an after action analysis, which is what made his book so terrific. But there was always, there's a little chip on his shoulder.
Totally.
And it's, you know, and sometimes it showed itself in his fights with the Democratic Party, in his own party. Yeah. Sometimes it showed itself in his bitterness with the Clintons. Sometimes, you know, vice versa. Where did that chip come from?
Well, first of all, just in terms of the diaries, like they were a great resource. I also got his unpublished diaries.
You got the unpublished, right? The really good stuff. Huh?
Some of them. Well, interestingly, and this tells you something else about Jimmy Carter, he didn't really edit them, so they made him look better.
Yeah.
You know, when he was editing his published diaries. And then he told me at one point, I can only express my true feelings in poetry. So I also included a few lines of his poetry. But I do think that this prickliness, this chip on his shoulder goes back to a very fraught relationship he had with his father, Mr. Earl Carter, who was a white supremacist. And his mother, Ms. Lillian, was a nurse who took care of black patients for free. And then he had a third parent, Rachel Clark, an illiterate black farmhand who did a lot to raise him and give him his love of nature. And so this upbringing, it made him a very, very complex person. So here's a guy who is, on the one hand, prickly and can be difficult. And as he acknowledged to me when I asked him what his biggest mistake as president was, he says, I didn't manage my relationships inside the Democratic Party, not just with Bill Clinton, who was governor of Arkansas and whom he had serious run-ins with when Clinton was president, right. But most important, Ted Kennedy, who challenged him for the Democratic nomination in 1980. And that really hurt Carter. Now, it was a combination of things that led to his defeat. I interviewed Paul Volcker not long before his death, and you know, Volcker jacked up interest rates to over 15% in an election year. Can you imagine getting reelected? Carter appointed him, and then when he ended inflation with his harsh medicine, Reagan got reelected because of what Volcker did
and reappointed
in 1984.
Volcker, I believe. He
did, but that was Carter's decision. Right. He just wasn't around. So anyway, I said to Volcker, you know, you essentially elected and reelected Ronald Reagan. And he said, yeah, I've heard that. And then he told me a story. He said he saw Carter, who he said he much admired, at a fishing lodge not long after the 1980 election. And he said, I'm sorry if I cost you the election. And Carter smiled, and I think he was genuine in this. Sometimes he had a fake smile, which we can talk about,
right.
And said, Paul, there were many factors. And he was right. So you had the Ted Kennedy challenge.
Yeah.
You always want to have a unified party. You had a sour economy, and you had the fact that he was basically held hostage in the White House by the Ayatollah Khomeini.
Right.
And those hostages came home safely, but not until right when Reagan was sworn in on January 20th, 1981, when it was too late to help Carter politically. His mother, Carter's mother, and his wife both told him, if you bomb Iran, you will win the election. And he, particularly Lillian, his mother, was pushing this on him. And he was like, you know, they'll kill the hostages. I can't.
He's right.
I can't do that.
I think that.
And so he.
Likely the outcome.
You know, while he did get too obsessed with the hostages, and he basically sent a message to the Ayatollah that was, you know, you have this leverage on me. So why would the Ayatollah give it up? So he kind of mismanaged that part of it. Ultimately, he got them back safely. And there's so, Chuck, there are so many other accomplishments that this guy had that people have completely forgotten
about. I want to talk about the Cold War because, you know, one of the more significant decisions that bankrupted the Soviet Union was the decision for the Soviet Union to go into Afghanistan and for the United States to basically back an insurgency. And it was Jimmy Carter that approved this, not Ronald Reagan.
Right.
But it did, I mean, this was, you know, probably the biggest blunder the Soviets made for the end of their run.
Yeah. So there were a few factors here that relate to the Cold War. In the summer of 1979, Carter signed a secret finding, as they call it, that to provide covert aid to the Mujahideen, the rebels. Now, there was blowback because Osama bin Laden was part of the Mujahideen.
Sure. No, so a decision. It helped end the Cold War, but it's messy.
And when I talked to Brzezinski about it, who was the engineer of this, he was, look, better to have won the Cold War and, you know, don't go there with bin Laden. He was very proud of it, even though it had been a secret for many, many years. But there are other things that Carter did that helped hasten the end of the Cold War. He built the B-2 stealth bomber. And this, Harold Brown was the Secretary of Defense, former head of the California Institute of Technology. They were developing stealth technology, GPS, like all kinds of things that Reagan benefited from. Now, Carter couldn't tell people about the B2. So when he canceled the B1, which was a lemon, he looked weak.
Weak,
but he was increasing the defense budget. So this whole weakness thing, which he told me early on in our many interviews, was the thing that bothered him the most. And I understand why it bothered him. It was basically a right-wing concoction, because anybody who knows Jimmy Carter knows that he's a tough SOB. Mm-hmm. And he was not soft. And just because, but when he kissed Brezhnev, or Brezhnev kissed him at Vienna, Leslie Gelb,
it's like a mafia standing kiss. There, and he, it's like Don Corleone kissing you.
And they all knew, Holbrooke knew, they all knew in the Carter administration that this was a problem. But they were signing the SALT II treaty. Both sides abided by the terms, even though after the invasion of Afghanistan, it wasn't ratified. But it became the predicate for Reagan's arms control. And then there's another factor that is very important, and among Jimmy Carter's major achievements was the human rights policy, which was hypocritical in some ways. For Cold War reasons, they had to support Marcos and some other dictators. Yeah. But if you if you listen to people like Larry Eagleburger, who was ambassador to Czechoslovakia at the time and was really anti the human rights policy because, you know, he was trying to deal with Tito and, you know, it was complicating his life.
Realpolitik, right? Yeah.
They said after the end of the Cold War, as did Vaclav Havel and many others, this human rights policy was essential in exercising what they call soft power and hollowing out the Soviet Union. And not to mention that in Latin America, it led to a major transition from authoritarian to democratic governments.
Here's something that Tom Brokaw had a unique vantage point. He was based in Atlanta for the civil rights movement.
I talked to him about it for my book.
So he was able to, he sort of saw Carter. And what's interesting, you know, the Carter he remembers when he first met him was sort of the bookworm in the legislature. He wasn't part of the good old boy network. I find it in 1970 remarkable that he was able to win a governor's race in the South with this sort of bookwormish personality.
Well, he did it by running a code word dog whistle campaign, and it was the low point of his entire epic American life. Mm-hmm. So what happened was he had run in 66 and was seen as the sort of more liberal candidate. It's all relative in Georgia, of course.
Right. Then there was only one party state. There was no, I mean,
well, actually,
there was mostly
Bo Calloway, who was later head of the RNC, almost became governor in 66, and it went
because of Lester Maddox, right?
Because the legislature decided. So eventually Maddox became governor, and Carter was pretty embittered by it, and he was going through after that election his born again experience, and he went door to door for Jesus in the North. At one point in 1968, he comes upon a madam in a brothel, and he spent a lot of time trying to convert the madam to Christ. There are so many epic things in this guy's life. His personal life is
filled with stories like this.
It's just fascinating. I mean, when he went to the core of a melted down nuclear reactor, Rachel Maddow did that on her show this week, but I have the most complete account of that. It's this amazing story where he risks his life going into this melted down nuclear reactor, secret nuclear reactor, many, many other stories. So 68, he's going through this kind of depression, born again experience. And he decides, I'm going to run again for governor and I'm not going to lose. And he says this to Hamilton Jordan. So he's running against a former governor named Carl Sanders, who, because you couldn't serve consecutive terms, who was making a comeback. And he had the Atlanta liberal moderate vote. So the only way for Carter to win was with the segregationist vote. And what he did was he talked about how much he liked George Wallace and that he would invite George Wallace into the state if he was elected governor, which of course he didn't do. And he went and paid a call on the founder of the White Citizens Council, which sent a huge message to the rural vote that Carter was one of them. Then when Vernon Jordan, who was for his opponent, complained to him about this. He said, Vernon, watch what I do, not what I say. And sure enough, moments after he is sworn in as governor, he says the time for racial discrimination is over. This was something that his Jewish Cessna pilot made him commit to doing, made him write out on a flight map on the last day of the campaign that he would do this, because this was a guy who was very close to the King family, and he introduced him to Daddy King, who became a very important supporter. So anyway, then that's on the front page of the New York Times, that he's repudiated.
Yeah.
So the whites in the audience are all, he betrayed us. And I found out, this had never been published before, that that his old colleagues from the state Senate, about a dozen of them, walked out of his inaugural as governor of Georgia when he said this. And the black voters in attendance were, he said, what?
They couldn't believe it.
And then he made good on it by integrating state government and becoming the Jimmy. So he spent the second half of his life, Chuck, making up for what he did not do in the first
half. That's really sort of, it explains... It explains his post-presidency, actually, a lot better, is understanding that he made this deal with the devil, and then he decided, I guess it's a way to put it, and he decided to, repent.
Yes, and he's very reluctant. I talked to him about this a lot. At one point he'd said, I never claimed to be part of the civil rights movement. I said, okay. I started asking him more questions about this 1970 campaign, and he quietly and nicely said, are we done talking about this yet? I said,
wow.
President Carter, not yet.
If he could move, whitewash anything in his background, it's that.
But you have to understand the context. So, by the way, he himself was very much on his mother's side, and he was enlightened on race from the time he was a boy. Mm. And at the Naval Academy, he protected the first black midshipman. Mm. He did the same with black crewmates when he was in the Navy. But then he comes home in 1953, Brown versus Board of Education happens. He's the chair of the Sumter County School Board. They don't even try to integrate the schools because under Georgia state law, they would all automatically close if even one black student went to a white school. And then this is where Tom Brokaw comes into the picture. In 1963 and 1965, there are these serious racial disturbances in Americus, which is the county seat, just a few miles from Plains, and Carter is representing it in the state Senate. And you had like the local sheriff, who Martin Luther King called the meanest man I ever met. He's using electrified cattle prods on 13-year-old black girls. This is what's going on down there. It made Bull Connor look like a nice guy. Wow. Okay. So this is a really, really scary time when, of white terrorism. And so when an integrationist who had an interracial farm, which later developed into Habitat for Humanity, which is a whole other story, but the locals boycotted, the local businesses boycotted this interracial farm. And, I wondered, why did Carter take part in that? And he knew better. And Rosalind and Lillian would secretly go out there and bring food. The reason he did is another business that tried to break the boycott was dynamited. They just blew up the whole business. Hmm. So there was a lot of fear. And also, if he was ambitious in politics, at one point he said to me, look, I had to choose. I could either be governor of Georgia or I could be active in the civil rights movement. And I chose to be governor of Georgia.
Ends justify the means is a complicated
decision. Very complicated.
It's always a complicated decision. Let's talk about his relationships with the former presidents. One of my favorite parts of his diaries, I thought it was fascinating. He was talking about during the Panama Canal debate, he was making a decision. He was going to, they were going to really, I can't remember the specific anecdote. Hopefully you do. And he said, and he told his staff, hey, make sure Governor Reagan gets a briefing on this. Even though he knew Reagan was his chief public antagonist, he thought it was important that Reagan get a briefing.
Yes.
And this is in the, he knew Reagan was the most, and he thought it was the right thing to do because he knew, and it was sort of an interesting early relationship he kind of developed, but Reagan, he expressed disappointment that Reagan never reciprocated when he was president.
Well, Reagan was the only former president he didn't have extensive connections to, and the only one that he, and particularly Rosalynn, who felt that Reagan made it people feel comfortable with their bigotry, that they didn't have any connection to.
And they never tried.
Left office.
And they didn't really
try. No, for a lot of reasons. But at that time, and this really tells you how different Washington is from 19.
It's one of my favorite little stories. Like this is like proper way. They were
so,
like, you know.
So he has this. This is where he drew close to Gerald Ford.
Reagan is pounding Carter publicly.
Right. Well, that's how Reagan became a national figure.
Was over the Panama Canal.
Right.
And he thought, I should at least tell him what we're up to.
Well, what he was trying to do. So he had Howard Baker on his side, but partly because of Reagan, 2/3 of the United States, of the voters, were against ratifying the Panama Canal treaties, and it needed a 2/3 vote in the Senate for ratifications. It was the heaviest of heavy lifts. Eventually, several senators were defeated because they supported these treaties. Right. So why? And Carter was told, second term, kick it down the road.
Yeah.
You're going to get killed on this. And this is one of the great things about Carter. He was, no, we have to do this, because the Joint Chiefs were telling him, if we don't do this, it will require a minimum of 100,000 troops in perpetuity the canal zone.
They were going to rise up. People were going to rise up.
And once there was sabotage against the canal, which is critical to global commerce, right? Then we would have to have a permanent troop presence in Panama defending the canal. And it would have been very hard to defend. It would have been, and this is why eventually it got through. But at the time he wanted Reagan briefed, the treaty had been negotiated mostly by a guy named Saul Linowitz, but with a lot of, because Carter's attention to detail, which was much maligned in this case and several others, was very, very important. They didn't want everybody in the Senate and people like Reagan trashing the treaty without having read the details and without having been briefed. And nowadays, people would be trashing it before the ink was even dry on the treaty. Right. But amazingly, with one or two exceptions, everybody in the Senate and even Reagan, for a critical time, because they were briefed on what was in the treaty, they held their fire until the Carter White House could line up their ducks a little better.
No, it said it's a fascinating story. It says a lot to me about Carter. It said a lot to me about Reagan, you know, also at the time. And he might have been an opportunist.
But then Reagan
right, he turned it into an opportunity. There's no doubt he was an opportunist.
He later then did begin to attack it. So Reagan doesn't cover himself in glory.
No.
And by the way, I asked Peggy Noonan years later, when Reagan became president, why didn't he just abrogate the treaties? Could have easily done that. Yeah. And she said, because he knew Carter was right, you know.
So this leads me to this sort of, you know, there's a reason we always say a picture's worth 1,000 words. And it's sort of this picture that gets used a lot. It's at Obama's inauguration, and it's all the living presidents. And there's this gap, right? There's this, and obviously it was probably just an accident, but it felt so symbolic. There's Carter separated from the rest of the club of presidents. He was, ironically, you tell me, he was closest to H.W. Bush, wasn't he?
Yeah. So, by the way, I interviewed 3 of the people in that picture for my book. Nice. And I'm not going to tell you exactly
which 3
they were, but I will say that I interviewed both Barack Obama and George H.W. Bush before he died about Jimmy Carter. And they all said that reflected reality, because they wanted to tell Obama, you know, the new president, like what the food's like, you know, and, you know, how you should watch out for this, you should watch out for that. And Carter wanted to press his agenda. And he was always the outsider throughout his whole life. Even when he was a little kid growing up on the farm in Archery, he was an outsider in Plains, the big city of 650, right? Because he was the farm kid, spoke, you know, with a weird farm twang. So he's always the outsider. But also he had these fraught relationships with all of them. Right. And just to start with George H.W. Bush, because you mentioned him. So
I single him out. It was my favorite part. And this is where I'm like, when Carter has a grudge, he never left to go on some of these things. And I remember him writing in his diaries, he says, you know, Reagan promised in briefings, the only one that ever actually returned his calls was H.W. Bush.
Yeah. So by this time, Gerald Ford was dead by the time of that picture when Obama was elected. He got very close to Ford because Ford gave him critical support in certain areas. They each pledged that they would speak at each other's, whoever died first. And Carter delivered a beautiful eulogy at Ford's funeral. But with HW, initially, they had a really, really good relationship because Carter went down to Nicaragua when a woman named Violeta Chamorro beat Daniel Ortega, who's back in, right? Yeah. So Ortega was a communist, and Carter at that time was starting as a former president, supervising elections in more than 100 countries. This was an important democracy promotion initiative that the Carter Center still has. So Ortega loses. Carter stays up with him all night, and he says, "It's hard to lose, I know. Leave power. Maybe you'll be back again someday," which he was.
Right.
And so Ortega became the first communist in history to relinquish power after an election.
Yeah.
And Bush
credited
told me when I interviewed him, you know, we were just so grateful for that. It took a big problem off of our plate, Nicaragua off our plate.
Yeah.
And, but then in 1991, in the run-up to the Gulf War,
Carter
sends a letter to all the heads of state, of members of the Security Council, saying, "Don't go with Bush on this. You know, this war is a bad idea." And the Bush people wanted to bring him up on the Logan Act. You know, they wanted some of them.
Right.
And Bush told me he was furious because we only have one president at a time, right. And a lot of Democrats agreed.
I remember that Carter was criticized by a lot of Democrats.
A lot of Democrats. It was just the wrong thing for him to do. And I tried to get him to admit that. And he kept saying stuff like, I wasn't saying anything privately that I wasn't saying publicly. But there's a difference when you're writing to heads of state. You just can't. So that's why that chapter is called Freelance Secretary of State. So this is one of the reasons.
That's why he had so many secretaries of state, because he wanted to be his own secretary of state.
No, he only had two. He had Cy Vance and Ed Muskie, but he did want to be his own secretary of state. Yeah. That wasn't so much the problem, but it is why he had problems with his successors, because he was always freelancing on them, going overseas. And you know, he had big problems with Bill Clinton in 1994, which was one of Jimmy Carter's best years in the post-presidency because he prevented wars in both Haiti and North Korea. But he did a star turn on CNN before he reported to the president. And when Clinton, when he finally got in there, he and Clinton had words like never seen between a president and a former president.
Wow.
Basically, Clinton was screaming at him. So, but then he shows up for his 75th wedding anniversary.
So one of the things that I was making note of to folks to understand, like, you know, that how long this ex-presidency was, that if Jimmy Carter became president at the age Joe Biden became president, he'd have been elected in 2000, Jimmy Carter. Yeah. So I guess my question to you is this, why didn't he ever run again?
Rosalynn wanted him to try to make a comeback, and I think he was hard-headed about it. And also, he was trying to figure out what to do.
The governor's race would tell you that, you know, his experience as governor would say, okay, you lose, you get up, put your pants back on, and you do it again.
Yeah, but, he didn't run for re-election as governor, as he told me, because the Constitution in Georgia
didn't
allow it.
Right.
But it said, if it had, would you have won? He goes, no, I would have lost. So because he made tough decisions as governor, and he knew he made tough decisions as president, and he was swamped by Ronald Reagan. So practically speaking, the idea of making a comeback didn't make sense. So Mondale ran instead. But also by 1984, he'd been a little depressed after he left the presidency. And in the middle of the night, he suddenly thinks, why can't I do as part of my library what we did at Camp David, which was this stunning achievement, the most durable peace treaty since World War II. And, you know, or what I did, you know, normalizing relations with China, the foundation of our global economy, that bilateral relationship. You know, Deng Xiaoping leaves Washington in 1979. He goes back to China. What's the first thing he does? He legalizes private property. China goes from sub-Saharan African GDP to the most astonishing boom in human history. This grows out of Carter's decision to normalize relations, which Ford would not have done. It would have been years before we had the global economy. I'm just introducing this to say that this man's achievements, setting aside the hostage crisis in foreign policy, are stunning.
No, I think they're sort of missed.
And people don't think about them. So he thought, can I do that in my post-presidency? Yeah. I'll do this thing, we'll call it the Carter Center. Mm-hmm. And he reinvented the post-presidency in the same way he reinvented the vice presidency by giving Mondale something to do and reinvented the role of first lady.
All right, we could keep going, but I want to wrap with this. I've been thinking about every 20th century president. And when you stand them all side by side, when you look at sort of how they all got there to the presidency, Carter's is actually it's the closest thing we have to what I would call citizen president.
Totally.
Nobody else got, you know, you had people that had to be in the military, you know, that felt like they were, I don't want to say groomed. First of all, that's a word that gets now redefined, but every other president we had came through the system, whatever the system was in the moment, not him. And maybe why he was in a one-term outlier. I don't know, but is he the one that is not like the others? Maybe the true citizen president, the only one we've had.
I think that's a great point. So he, somebody said it's like picking somebody out of the phone book.
No, he was well qualified. It was sort of picking somebody based on pure qualifications.
He was totally qualified.
Nuclear engineer. I mean, these are some interesting things that I'd like a president to have in their background. So Naval Academy, things like
his, that. What happened with Carter is after he becomes governor, he meets all the big shots in the Democratic Party as they come down to Georgia to give a speech or whatever. And he thinks, look, a governor knows where the rubber meets the road. These senators, they're just in a debating society. I'm smarter and I'm more qualified to be president. And he had that astonishing self-confidence that they all need in order to run for president.
I was just going to say, you have to be a little overly confident.
What happened with him was he was fortunate enough to catch the wave of Watergate. Yeah. So people wanted a healer after Nixon.
And they wanted an outsider too.
And they wanted an outsider, somebody who wasn't connected to Washington. And then you saw it on the clip that you played from Meet the Press. He was able to say, I want a government as good as the American people. So he could flatter the people and say, if we can just have a people's president in there instead of the Washington establishment. But then what happened was when he got there, so he wouldn't have been president without Watergate, and he might not have been defeated if it wasn't for Watergate, because the Watergate press corps jumped on him, right? The post-Watergate press corps. So Jody Powell
is antagonistic press corps
from the get-go. So Jody Powell said,
"Yeah, we're not going to get snow." The way press corps reacted,
not only did,
"Hey, we got treated. We're not doing that again. Right. We're going to assume you're always lying."
Everything was a gate, and they assumed he was lying, even though he wasn't lying. And Jody Powell said, "Not only did we not have a honeymoon, we didn't even have a one-night stand with the press." And that was true. And when I look back, the coverage, it was astonishingly harsh about Carter, where it had been very favorable during the campaign. I don't think, though, that there's a lot of legislation that would have gone through if he just hadn't antagonized the Georgetown set.
Yeah.
You know, because he signed more bills in 4 years than Reagan, Bush, George W. Bush, Obama, or Clinton did in 8 years, in part because he had an overwhelming Democratic Congress.
I mean, that was a big deal.
This was important stuff. Not only did he put solar panels on the roof of the White House, which Reagan took down, 15 major pieces of environmental legislation, the first overhaul the civil service in 100 years, the creation of FEMA, Department of Education, Energy. I could go on for a really long time about all of these bills he signed that the press paid very little attention to. They were focused on him getting attacked by a killer rabbit, and
he fell running a marathon, by the way, he was running a marathon. Why wasn't that the wow? He was running a marathon.
Yeah, and so that's always a symbol of
weakness, right?
You know, and so really, we in the press, we did not cover ourselves in glory in the way that
Jimmy Carter was a victim of narratives and memes before we knew what narratives and memes would do to people.
Exactly.
Jonathan Alter, it's good to see you. You well?
I'm doing great. Yeah, and I'm just glad that Jimmy and Rosalynn Carter are around to see this reappraisal. And, you know, he was in bad odor for so many decades, but now it reminds me of what George Orwell, who said about Mahatma Gandhi. And Orwell thought that Gandhi was righteous, you know, the way so many people think about Carter, he said. But Orwell went on to say, what a clean smell he has left behind for all of us.
That's a great line, and it's a great way to say it, because you can't find a single person that will say a negative thing about the character of Jimmy Carter.
That's right.
And that's something with so little character in politics. It's nice to lionize someone with character and then some. All right, my friend.
Thanks, Chuck.
Thank you, man.